Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What's happening, friends? Welcome to another episode of our monthly interview series. It is called IGN Unfiltered. My name is Ryan McCaffrey, and my guest this week, Dennis Dyack. If you don't necessarily know his name, you will know his resume for sure. Let's go through it. So currently, Dennis, the CEO of Apocalypse Studios. We'll talk about your new game, Dead House Sonata, later on in this interview. But Silicon Knights, that is where I think most of our audience will know you from. Your resume has Blood Omen Legacy of Kain on it, Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem on it, Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes on it, Two Human on there, X-Men Destiny. It is quite a roster. Thank you so much for joining me, Dennis.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot to talk about. You've been an outspoken guy in your career. You've been a prominent developer with Microsoft, with Nintendo, on the PC, PlayStation. You know everyone. You've done it all. I always like to go back and we'll go like the Batman Begins origin story here.
Sure.
When did you fall down the well and the bats attacked you? Like, what drew you to games as a kid?
So, I really started paying attention to games really early on when I was younger and I was playing Ultima. And there was this game, Ultima 3, which goes way, way back. Huge fan of RPGs. And I was playing Ultima 3, and I was stuck. My party was in a boat, and there was this whirlpool that was going around, and I didn't know where to go. I was stuck, essentially.
Yeah.
I had explored everything, and the ship, I wasn't paying attention. I was super tired. The ship got sucked into the whirlpool, and I got really angry. I thought everyone was dead, and then boom, it opened up a new world. And I that whole moment of how I felt at that point, I realized at that point that I wanted to do that.
Yeah,
have that give that experience to other people.
That's cool. So you can. That's such. I love that you can trace it back to a specific moment in a specific game.
Exactly that time.
Yeah. Have you had the opportunity in your career to speak to Richard Garriott about
that?
Yes.
So I've spoken to him a little, not as much as other people that I know, and I'm a big fan of his games. He's a really good guy, but I've never had a chance to like sit down and have a coffee. And as we're talking now, it's been like at a show where he's super busy. So it's been, hey, I'm Dennis. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, I know some of your stuff. And that was it. So.
Oh, we got to fix that.
I would love to sit down.
I don't have a lot of power in this industry, but I know Richard was in here. He did the
show. Oh, wow.
He told me a million great stories. You should check that episode out, actually.
Oh,
he's been to space, as you probably know.
I do know that. Yeah.
I think I can facilitate.
I would love to sit down with him. He's a great guy.
Absolutely, yeah. It's awesome. So, that answers my next question, which is, you know, the bug bit you right there because you focused on computer science in college.
Right.
So you were locked in and you knew what you wanted to do.
Well, that's kind of a strange story. Not really at first. So at that point, that was when I was in high school and I was taking a few computer courses. But when I went to university, I was on the varsity wrestling team, and a lot of people don't know this, but I was a full contact Canadian Taekwondo champion.
Wow.
I was into a lot of physical sports, and I went to a university called Brock University in Niagara. They have the best wrestling team in Canada. They've won the Canadian championships for like 25 years in a row.
Wow.
Or something. So I went there to wrestle. So my first degree was in phys ed.
Okay.
And I was still playing video games, but I just wanted to wrestle. And so I was into a lot of contact sports. I went from like different types of martial arts to wrestling. And as I was graduating from phys ed, I really had sort of career choices to make. I could have become a teacher, which a lot of phys ed teachers, a lot of phys ed graduates do. I could have went into pharmaceuticals because, you know, you take a lot of physiology and
sure.
stuff, right? And the other one was I applied to the RCMP and got accepted. And I looked at all those and I just started dating my wife now, Joanne. And a good friend of mine said, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I just want to make video games. And he was like, well, why don't you make video games? I was like, I'm not confident. I don't have the tools. I've got all these ideas, but I don't think I'm smart enough to make games. He goes, well, go into computer science. And I was like, I don't think I'm smart enough for computer science. And he really said, don't let anyone tell you you can't do something. So I went into computer science and my average, it's different. It's not the same as in the US. So I'll just give percentages.
Yeah.
I was like, I guess a 72, 75 average in phys ed.
Okay.
But I graduated high honors, like 92 plus in computer science. So I did really well in computer science. And then just as I made my first game as I was doing my undergraduate, I then started my master's in computer science and artificial intelligence, neural networks and user interfaces.
Wow.
And then
you found your calling.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. And I felt then empowered. I learned a ton of lessons. And with that computer science degree in my pocket, there were no video game courses back then. There was no such thing.
Right.
And even back then, it wasn't even clear if there was a video game industry. Because don't forget, I'm in Canada. There wasn't Silicon Valley. So with our first game, I literally flew out here hoping I'd find a video game industry. And our first game was published, which was called... Cyber Empires.
Cyber Empires. I was going to ask you about it.
Yeah, and it actually won Multiplayer Game of the Year by Computer Gaming World before there was an internet. So it was a hot seat. It was very much like the Total War series, and except it was a hot seat game where you played on a wristboard and then the fighting would occur in real time. So I've always liked the Total War series too, but this was obviously way before. And that's how it all started.
Wow. So I'm curious, this is unrelated to the game stuff. Did your martial arts training make you a better wrestler and vice versa? Did those complement each other?
Believe it or not, a lot of my friends went into mixed martial arts just as it started exploding.
Yeah.
So a lot of the sort of early champions were, a lot of them were wrestlers. I knew them all. It did translate. And frankly, it translated to video games too. Despite what everyone might think, it's really tough to make games. You go through a lot of punishment. And those people who know me, I've had some extreme highs and some very deep lows. And getting through that takes a lot of, just a lot of focus on this is what you want to do. And, it's a tough, tough industry. So, yeah.
So Silicon Knights, you start that at 26. You're 26 years old. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Cyber Empires. You mentioned what it is, but what do you remember about that game? Like either something you learned in the process of actually making something that your studies never prepared you for, or just kind of what about that project? Like the first thing that comes to mind about that project when I mention it.
It was purely fueled by exuberance and excitement for the industry. And I guess what I would call my first golden rule of making games really got solidified. And what the golden rule is for me, when you're making video games, you never know if you're going to please anyone. So a lot of people will say, do this. This is the market that's going to be hot. And you're at GDC now, you hear all of this stuff, right? And the noise is insane. So what I learned was, if you make a game that you like yourself, you're guaranteed to please at least one person. And that generally, that love for that game will come through in what you're making.
Yeah.
So in Cyber Empires, when we won that award, that came out of nowhere. I didn't know anyone in Computer Gaming World. I had no contact with the West Coast. I was like blown away. I was like, oh, we won an award. And it's one of those things where it was so neat And the industry was so new. I remember showing my mother that. And I said to her, she read the article and she took it. And so she hit me over the back of the head with it. And I was like, what happened? Why are you hitting me with this magazine? And she's like, you said you're from St. Catharines, which is in Niagara, where I'm from. And she goes, you're not from St. Catharines. You're from Meriton, which is a small principality that got absorbed into St. Catharines. And I don't even refer to St. Catharines anymore. I really think that Niagara should be one city. No one really knows St. Catharines when you talk about it here on the West Coast, but they know Niagara.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember from getting that.
That was what your mom took away.
That's what my mom took away from it. And I was like, oh, God. So, those are some of the things that I remember from Cyber Empires. It was a really good time. We had no idea what we were doing, but the passion led to the finish,
yeah,
which I think is still consistent to what I do today.
And did you get, did CGW send you a trophy? Did you guys get a trophy too?
Yes, I think so. I think so. It's going to sound really
terrible. Where is it now?
I've lost a lot of them. I used to have a trophy case, but there was like a ton of, if you're in this industry for a while and you do all right, you know, you get a lot of these, and I've lost a lot of them. So I know it's terrible.
Oh, that is a shame.
Yeah.
That's a shame. All right. So then let's fast forward a little bit to Legacy of Kain. Yep. Blood Omen, Legacy of Kain. Mm-hmm. That was, I think maybe you disagree, I don't know, but that was the breakthrough game.
Absolutely.
That was the breakthrough game. So what do you remember about that game? When do you know you've got something great? Is it not till after it comes out, or is it sometime during the development process where you're like, we got something here?
It's really, so you have this feeling when you talk to people, there's this resonance, and it's never something you can put your hand on or something that you can touch and feel. There's no metrics you can go, this is a guaranteed hit. But there's that feeling that you have by people talking to you. And so I remember all kinds of showing people all kinds of things on the show floor at E3. This is back when you'd show things before they were done. And this is way, way back. This is like, actually, might not have even been E3. It might have been CES back in the times when
Vegas,
things were...
Yeah, or yeah, Chicago.
So the one story I remember about Legacy of Kain was there was these bunch of people were coming by, but then this Japanese person came by and he started asking me questions. And I started answering. And like, I'll talk. And this went on for half hour to 45 minutes.
Wow.
Right. And I'm like, okay. And then, you know, he walked away, said, thank you very much. And he goes, what's your name, Dennis? And I said, what we're doing. And so he walked away. And then four other people came over and like, you know who that was? And I was like, no. And he goes, that's Mr. Arakawa. And he runs Nintendo of America. And I was like, I knew very little about the console industry at that point because the PlayStation was my first. Like, I obviously loved Nintendo, but I was like, oh, cool. And that's when I started thinking this could be a good game.
Yeah.
So that was it's one of those things where we were the only. So back then, so here's what I believe about Legacy of Kain. And I guess when, even with Dead House Sonata now, why I'm going back to, I think, my roots with Legacy of Kain. Legacy of Kain, I studied the medium a lot. And people will say, well, what does that mean? I'm a huge Marshall McLuhan fan. The medium is the message. And back then, when the PlayStation came out, for the first time, we had this technology called a CD-ROM.
650 megabytes.
That's right. But it allowed you, before then it was all cartridge.
That's right.
And I love playing RPGs, and I'm an avid reader. I hated reading on a television.
Yeah.
It was really blocky. It hurt your eyes. And I was like, wow, we can actually put voice on this so people don't have to read. And if you look at Legacy of Kain, and people don't necessarily remember, there's no text anywhere. It's all voiceover. And so that, studying the medium, I think, really helped that game break out. And that's what I remember. There's a couple things about Legacy of Kain that I remember the most that resonate with me personally is we were able to tell stories in a different way that people were used to. Not only was there an anti-hero where you're the vampire, the world hates you, and you're the only one who can save the world, but the way that we were able to tell the story hadn't really been done before because that medium didn't exist. And the other thing was I started looking at what made that game successful, and I started thinking about engagement theory. Why was Kain Why did it stand out? What made Kane special? There's a lot of introspection there. Because that was our first RPG. Before then, we were doing real-time strategy games, right? And that helped me, I guess, create a compass for what games I wanted to create in the future. So those Legacy of Kain is a huge watermark for myself personally, and will always have a special place in my heart. So.
Now, the great Amy Hennig worked on that project.
Yes.
And so what do you, did you learn a lot from her and vice versa?
So it's such a strange thing. So, it'll probably shock you. And I've seen some interviews. I don't know if it's the one that you did at DICE, but I've seen some things at previous conferences. So when Amy came on board, it wasn't in a story capacity at all. She was introduced to me as an art manager. And I liked her. I liked working with her. And I think, so she came on the project where Legacy of Kain, it was ending. So she had just joined Crystal. And by time the project finished, I think that's when she became a design director.
Yeah.
So her role changed as we were there, but she was in California and we were in Niagara working on the game.
Right.
And she oversaw some of the game designers that came and worked with us in Niagara and stuff. And, you know, we went over the story and we talked about a lot of things, but it was more at the design and art level, and not the story at that point was pretty much set.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so seeing her change and seeing her really come into her own in storytelling was very interesting. And so we talked a lot about theory and story, and I had no idea she was going to go in that direction. And we're very similar in the ways that we think story is important, but we also come at it from two different schools of thought. I think she's very traditional in the sense of, this is, you know, my opinion, and I hope she doesn't get upset, but it's not negative. It's she comes at it from a very traditional character-focused perspective where you look at poetics, every character that has a line in the story has to mean something. I come up from a world building perspective. So, that's not traditional and it's not necessarily three acts, and you really build the world first. It's a very sort of Tolkien-esque approach or a Babylon 5 approach where the world is almost more important than the characters.
Right.
And those are very different approaches, but they can result in the same things. And when she took over the Legacy of Kain stories afterwards, like I saw the shift. But the gamers didn't, and they loved it. And it was just great to see that continued. And so, I haven't spoken to her now for 3 or 4 years, and I want to catch up with her as well. I understand that I think she's at Google now. Is that correct?
She's been playing around with, some VR stuff, and yeah, she seems to be kind of waiting to see what she wants to do next from what I could gather.
I could be wrong, but it's rumors. We're at GDC right now, in case people are wondering when this is shooting, but I thought she is now at Google.
Maybe.
But I could be wrong.
I don't know. That could be news to me as well.
It's a rumor. It's a rumor. Anyway, I'd love to catch up. I think she's a great person, and it was really fun working with her.
Yeah, when I sat down with her, she in the context of explaining what her Star Wars game was going to be at EA, she completely deconstructed the Star Wars films to me in a way that was so like smart and so simple that I'd never even thought about it like
sure.
that.
Yeah.
But have you followed along with her career in the sense of have you played all the Uncharted games and kept up with
not just, all but a lot.
Yeah.
And I love her work. I think she does really cool stuff, and I look forward to seeing what she's doing next, that's for sure.
All right. So we move forward a little bit. So this is Dennis Dyack, this is your life. This is your career.
Sure.
So I mean this in the nicest way possible, but Dennis, how does a studio in a quiet Canadian border town hook up with Nintendo?
That's a really good question. I think because we were aligned so much in what we thought as development groups, and I'll tell the story, but let me explain some context of that first. There's really two schools of thought in the video game industry when it comes to making games and getting them out there. And the one approach is a very, what I would consider a marketing-based company where they'll spend tons of money marketing a game, and usually potentially multiples more than they'll spend on the development. Those are marketing based. That's most of the video game industry.
Sure.
Where the budgets will be, maybe it's $100 million for the game, and the marketing budget's $500 million, right? And they're, it's like this crazy numbers, right?
Yeah, the Activision approach.
Yeah, exactly. And Nintendo's very development focused. And we're completely development focused as well. And, you know, much easier to say for a developer. And so we, right after Legacy of Kain, we had a tech demo for 2Human. And 2Human, it used the same engine as Legacy of Kain, but I did one thing that was, I thought, I'm always looking at the medium. What can I do with the medium? How can I make it more seamless? And
yeah.
what different things with this new medium can I do? So back then, we had some cinemas that would seamlessly go into the top-down approach. So imagine 2Human in a Kain engine. So it was a 2D ISO that would, the cinematics would seamlessly go into the game. So there's no cuts.
Oh, cool.
Right. So we had that demo working. I was all excited. I was like, well, this is really cool. And Final Fantasy VI, I think, is it VI, was announced. And that's when they started doing the seamless cinemas. And I was crushed. I thought, well, we're going to be the first to do this. And then Final Fantasy is showing all the stuff at E3. But Nintendo was interested enough to say, well, clearly you didn't copy them because you're here at the same time. And they started asking why I wanted to do that. And I think when I started talking about the medium and where I see the medium of video games going, they... I think it aligned with them. And so we started very slowly, and we had to work with them a long time, prove that we could do technology. At the time, we were working on the N64.
Yes.
And so we had to write a lot of 3D stuff. And for those who don't know, while we were working on Eternal Darkness with them, we got really, really far on Eternal Darkness with the N64. And then Nintendo made the decision that they would stop making games on the N64 and everything had to go to the GameCube. We had to start over. That was tough. That was tough. A lot of the team was very upset. But in the end, it was the right decision because the platform was really cool. I'm a huge GameCube fan. So, yeah, so that's how that started. That 2Human demo to them, not necessarily the game, but I think the approach we were taking to it really resonated with them. So
I tell people all the time, for me, I love Mario Sunshine. Mm. I love a lot of stuff. But for me, Eternal Darkness, I think, is the greatest GameCube game.
Oh, thank
I really
you.
Do. It's my favorite. I'll put it that way, at least. So do you think, based on what you just told me, absolutely see how it could be demoralizing to have to effectively start over after doing a bunch of God knows how much work on the GameCube or on the N64. But did that make Eternal Darkness a better game in the sense that did you have a chance to rectify any mistakes or reevaluate things and have a chance to make it again for the first time effectively?
Well, yeah. So we had an opportunity to really look at, I think there's a lot of things with Eternal Darkness that really set it apart. You know, certainly one was the sanity system.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, another was the camera system. And if you remember at the time, all sort of, I guess, horror games were tank control. And what we did is we tried to do a seamless camera system that you didn't control, but sort of flowed like you'd see in a movie. And this was, you know, I think God of War, Assassin's Creed, after Eternal Darkness came out, they certainly looked at it and adopted a lot of our techniques. And I was lucky enough to, I'm a big believer in academics, and we had two tenured professors on staff at Silicon Knights. One, who's a really good friend of mine still, and who's now at Apocalypse, Dr. Barry Grant, where him and I came up with a camera system and we pitched it to Miyamoto-san and stuff saying,
oh, wow,
this is where we think, because back then doing a third-person camera was very tough. And there was a lot of push to go towards a first-person camera. And we had this basically break down why it was important for story. So a lot of people don't know this, but film, as it initially started, was all first person. And then they started realizing by doing shots on people's faces and showing emotion that you can relate more and it's better for storytelling.
Yeah.
So I was able to work with Barry and our Dr. Barry Grant, and He was able to help me put together solid researched reasoning on why a third person camera would be better for Eternal Darkness. And the GameCube, of course, was very fast, and we were able to do very smooth transitions, and of course more powerful than the N64. So it was kind of like starting over, but we had a lot more polish time. The only thing that sort of took it sideways was, unfortunately, 9/11, where we had to rewrite a lot of the story. Eternal Darkness almost got canceled.
Really?
Because of 9/11. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What in the story? Refresh me.
Yeah, so we had... It was very historically based, and we had a crusader in the game. And back then, after 9/11, there was a lot of talk about a new crusade, and lots of, like, there was anthrax going through the mail, and people were like, anything with sort of Middle Eastern content, people were like, kill this game. And so we had to rewrite it and just remove all of that stuff. And there was nothing negative towards anyone. It was just historical perspective about a fantasy game. But it, so we would have made launch of the end.
Oh, that was the goal.
GameCube. Yeah, okay. No, we were on target. But we had to rewrite several stories in the game and pull all that stuff out. And that was very, very different. That was an experience. But I'm really happy to say is that all the people at Nintendo, you know, Iwata-san, I really miss him, Miyamoto-san, those guys care about good games, and I sat down with them. I flew down to Japan for all this, and I just told them, I think this game should be made. And they're like, why? And they're like, can you do this? Can you guarantee you'll pull all this content out? And we just went crazy and just pulled it all out, made sure it was safe. We had like a million like lawyers look at it.
Sure.
And it was very tough, but in the end it worked out. And, you know, I don't think the story stuff suffered. And people remember it as it was intended. So it's good. It's good. It was a good experience, but it was pretty, like I said, making video games, very hard.
Well, it sounds like there's a book to be written just about Eternal Darkness's development between the N64 and then the 9/11 stuff. And
yeah.
What a road that was.
But yeah.
Boy, I bet you can really be proud of what came out of it.
Thank you. Yeah, I am. I think there's so many good memories there, and I've been really lucky with the opportunities I've been given, you know, to have a chance to work with, you know, Miyamoto-san and Nintendo, and, you know, look, Legacy of Kain, when we created it, that was our first story-driven game. We were just like, let's go do this, and we just happened to bump into the right people to have it align, and, you know... We were just talking, and like when we finished Legacy of Kain, I got a chance to meet Phil Harrison, who was, you know, at the time.
Moved on to Xbox. Yeah.
Well, no, he was at Sony at the time.
At the time, yeah.
At the time, and then he moved on to Xbox,
right.
And now he's at Google.
Yeah.
And it's just so funny because we're talking about all these things, and, you know, you get a chance to do these things, and it's really a hard industry, but it's you look back and you're just like, wow, these were just amazing opportunities. And it really makes me excited. And Eternal Darkness, we have, you know, a lot of people saying, this was my favorite game. Please make another one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, it feels really good as a developer for people to want to do that. And, you know, even Legacy of Kain, on our YouTube channel, I don't know if you've seen it, but we did an interview with sort of super hardcore Legacy of Kain fans who deconstructed an early alpha build to find lost content. So they called us up and said, hey, can we ask you questions about the build? And I was like, it's 20 years ago, but sure. And it was good. It's fun.
The content aside, the content that you had to cut from Eternal Darkness aside, mm-hmm. Would you have rather been a launch title for GameCube, or were you happy with kind of coming out a little into it with an installed base?
Yeah, you're gonna find with me. I'm pretty happy with the way things have gone in general. So I wouldn't want to change anything. Obviously that was out of our control.
Sure.
And I think the ability to, you know, make those changes and diversify under conditions that you don't expect you'll ever be faced with is a testament to the game concept itself is solid. And so we were able to work around it. So no, I wouldn't change anything. You know, we certainly at that point got a reputation for always being late. And I don't know how bad that is. So it's just sort of like,
well, you know, you got Miyamoto's famous saying, right?
Yeah.
A bad game is bad forever.
That literally we had a poster of at Silicon Knights that had that up there because it was really tough because back then and Eternal Darkness was very much anticipated by, you know, the Nintendo fans. And the fact that we had to delay it by several months, there was some unhappy people. So
well, one more Eternal Darkness question.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm just curious. So you touched on it, but probably the signature element of Eternal Darkness among it being a great game overall was the sanity meter and the sanity effects. So you're breaking the fourth wall. You're doing all kinds of cool stuff. Testing your memory, were there any of those that were really cool that hit the cutting room floor that didn't make it into the game for one reason or another?
No, actually. Now, there were some ones that were almost got cut and that we, again, literally sat down with Mr. Miyamoto and many of the crew at, NCL, and that made it in, that made me so happy. But they were extremely dangerous. But what it showed to me is how much Nintendo cares about their consumers. Like, as game developers, I think we work for gamers. That is rule number one.
Yeah.
And so the particular sanity effect that I'm referencing here is the one where it starts deleting your memory card really slowly. So that was my personal favorite. I sat down and made sure that sort of meter went really slow enough for people to start screaming. And
I could see how Nintendo might freak out a little bit on that one.
Well, there's a good reason, and I hadn't thought about it, right? Because I'm a game developer. I'm like, this is going to be awesome. And they're like, so Mr. Miyamoto sat down with a bunch of engineers and said, Dennis, what if someone looks at that, gets really angry, and throws their GameCube against the wall because they think it's bugged out? And he goes, is that our fault? And it caught me. I was like, I don't know, maybe. And he goes, well, what do we have to do for customer service for that? Have you thought of that? And I was like, I haven't. He goes, have you ever seen anything like this before? And I was like, no. And he goes, well, what do you think? And I said, I think because you're saying, have you ever seen this before, that we should do it, because I don't think anyone has done it before. And he sat back and everyone looked around and they're like, we think this is very risky, but we'll do it. And that's what I remember the most. With Eternal Darkness, we pushed a lot of barriers. Like, Eternal Darkness was not a typical Nintendo game.
Oh, no.
And when you look at the whole Lovecraftian mythos, it doesn't appear in any other Nintendo franchises, right? And the whole idea that they would walk down that road with us and think about it. Again, talking about Babylon 5, multiple characters, there's like 12 characters, most of which die.
Right.
And that is not a typical game that comes out of Nintendo. And they were on board so far to even, you know, with that example. And I had never considered that possibility. And there's a lot of, I think, goodwill that went into that. And they believe in gamers. And and I said to them, I think that experience will be something that gamers will remember forever. And
as a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system. So wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I think so, yeah, it's my favorite.
So how did Eternal Darkness do? Sales-wise, did it do very well?
Yeah, it did.
Sure deserved to.
Well, it did well, considering the numbers on the console. And the GameCube, which is one of my favorite consoles, did not do well compared to other consoles.
Yeah.
So if you look at what we call penetration rates, our number of sales for the number of consoles out there, it did well. However, because the GameCube did not sell as much as, say, the Switch has
or
anything, right? So it was the lowest selling console. It didn't break a million units. It got close, but which was unfortunate. But I think it resonated really well with the Nintendo crowd. So Legacy of Kain sold more. And at the same time, which is great, but I think in many ways, Eternal Darkness really had a strong resonance within the Nintendo community, and many people have said to me, that's my favorite, you know, GameCube game of all time. And some have said of, you know, Nintendo game of all time. And so, though it didn't do the numbers, maybe I'm happy to say it's kind of like a Blade Runner. Like, Blade Runner is my favorite film of all time. Yeah. It did not do massive box office numbers.
Right.
I don't care. I just look at it as like, what did it do, as an achievement? And, you know, I think it changed the way people thought about video games, which is important to me.
So who does Nintendo own it?
Yes.
So they've got it.
Yes.
Have you talked to them? I mean, we'll talk a little later about, you know, there was your spiritual successor.
But
it sounds like it was a good process with Nintendo, and they really believed in you, and you
Amazing.
Believed in them, and Why haven't hasn't this game come back around?
Well, there's a
either
couple,
from you or even from somebody else potentially if they own it.
Well, there's a bunch of stories related to that. So the first one is, a lot of people are always asking, well, why did you leave Nintendo? And I love Nintendo. I always will love all the memories. And back in that time, it was when the Switch was coming out, and there was a complete shift within Nintendo to move away from deep RPGs and story-based games and move towards quick, I would say, like party
games. More portable friendly
stuff. Yeah, and that was the whole goal of Nintendo, and they wanted us to make those kind of games too, and I didn't think that I could serve that role well. Don't get me wrong, I loved Nintendo. They were always good with us, and I just being much younger than I am now, certainly it was not maybe the best business move, but I think from a creative standpoint, I wanted to do another large story-driven game, and it just didn't fit within the Nintendo world. And as much as I spoke with, you know, Mr. Miyamoto and Mr. Iwata, they were like, Dennis, we love you, but can't you do a game like this? And I'm like, I don't know how. I don't know if you even want me to make those games. And I go, my team's not built for it. And so we eventually, separated ways, which was heartbreaking, I think, for everybody.
Yeah.
It wasn't, there was no drama or fallout.
Right.
It was just, Nintendo was going in a certain corporate direction. Now, if I would have been much smarter and much older, I would have realized that eventually they're going to come back because they're Zelda,
yeah.
And they have, right? So they're doing the hardcore games again, and it's just like, so I guess it, maybe an older, wiser Dennis would say, wait it out for 8 years and it'll all come back, which it has. So
the door could still be open. You never
know. Oh, I would always love to work with Nintendo, and I've got a lot of good friends there. And, I don't, so with Eternal Darkness, a lot of people don't know this. As Silicon Knights was slowly dying, we were in the process of getting the rights back. And but it never completed.
Yeah.
So when you look at Precursor and the spiritual successor, there were still, even back then, potential negotiations going on, but it obviously never happens,
right?
So, which was unfortunate.
Well, the other game that you did with Nintendo before that partnership faded away was of course Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get to work directly with Kojima much on that? Is he super hands-on with something like that? Or?
Well, he was hands-on. So, well, the story, I think, tells the clearest picture from a perspective of, we just finished Eternal Darkness. I remember all this because it was in the summertime. It was my birthday. I had my birthday. My birthday is July 24th. So I was at Nintendo getting Eternal Darkness. I just finished. We're getting, all this stuff. People are super happy with it. And I'm sitting down and we're talking about our next projects and what they're going to be. And I'm thinking it's probably going to be Too Human. We'll talk. And then there's a large cafeteria at NCL. And so I've been working with Mr. Miyamoto and Mr. Iwata for some time. And so Mr. Miyamoto comes over and he starts eating sushi with me. And it's no big deal. So we're just talking. But then Mr. Iwata comes over and then everyone in the cafeteria is looking over. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? They sit back and they say, hey, Dennis, we're thinking about doing a Metal Gear Solid. Would you be interested in doing it? And I'm like, so I almost choke on my food. I'm like, what? And we've been talking with Mr. Kojima, and he's always wanted to work with us. And he wants to do a Metal Gear Solid game. And unfortunately, he's working on Metal Gear Solid 3. He's too busy. And I told him that I had a perfect team. And he goes, that team is you. And I went, what? And he's like, do you want to do Metal Gear Solid? And I go, is this serious? And he's like, yes, this is very serious.
Wow.
Mr. And so they're like, yes, Dennis, this is serious. And I go, if you want me to do a Metal Gear, I'll do it. I said, I have no idea how this is going to go or what we're going to do. And he goes, that's okay. We've got a meeting tomorrow in Tokyo. We're all going on the bullet train. And so we got on the bullet train and the deal was done. I think it came from Japan home and told people we were doing Metal Gear Solid. And people were like, what are you talking about?
Dennis, what have you done?
Yeah, exactly. But there's another example of what an awesome experience, right? So I think we brought like 15 or 20 people to Konami headquarters in Tokyo, sat down with the team. Everyone got to know everyone. We really, got to learn Mr. Kojima's thought process on all of the stuff that he was doing.
Yeah.
And our job was to take the gameplay of Metal Gear 1 and Metal Gear 2, put it in, make the game, and, sort of work on making something new while he was working on Metal Gear 3. So he visited the studio often. We had video conference calls all the time. So yeah, he's very hands-on. He's a great guy. And man, those guys, they work hard, right? And so they're always working towards perfection. And I think from a polished standpoint, I don't think anyone does anything more polished than him. He's way up there. It's certainly in the top 10 in the industry. And I would say like Eternal Darkness cinemas compared to his, his cinemas were much more polished. And we learned a lot from that. I learned a lot and how we did it. And
that was my next question, is what do you learn from Hideo Kojima?
Oh, just how he will get things done and not when, often in this industry, you'll hear this a lot from anyone, not just like doing X is impossible. And I've never seen him like say, I'm going to do this and not be able to solve that problem. And some of those problems are like steep hills. I'm like, well, yeah, how are we going to do this? Like, there's even times at Metal Gear, I was like, how are we going to do all this? And it all came together and it was just like, wow, okay. And it was just a tremendous experience.
So, all right, let's fast forward to Human, I think we're up to here. Yes. How do you end up hooking up with Microsoft on that?
Well, so that was literally from the previous conversations where I said, you know, with Nintendo, we didn't know how to do party games. And the same guys, so we have agents, we had agents at the time, and the agents that represented us and got us connected with 2Human.
Right.
Soon as we decided that, look, we're going to go forward with 2Human. We don't think that fits within Nintendo. Unfortunately, Nintendo just wasn't, wasn't the type of game they were looking for. So we said, hey, we're going to have to take it to the market. These guys were connected with everyone in the industry. And I guess, well, Microsoft was also in Seattle. They heard right away, and we had meetings really fast. And it happened like super fast. They were like, we love this game. We want to do it. Let's go for it.
And do they sign you? Like, is it signed up as a trilogy straight away?
Yes.
So right away, you've got the pitch for 3 games.
Yes.
And they're on board. I mean, they already had Mass Effect going, I guess, at that point, which
correct.
Was also planned as a trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah. And they would talk about it as, we have this other project that we can't talk about that's similar in nature, but very different. And I had no idea what that was till Mass Effect was
right.
announced.
They're an RPG. You're more of an action game.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, so that was interesting stuff. But I got to know the guys from BioWare really well, because of their relationship with Microsoft. So we hung out a lot together, really liked those guys. So
fellow Canadians.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So it was supposed to be a trilogy. And I mean, what do you think happened there? Do you think you kind of put the cart before the horse, or what?
No.
Ultimately, what happened with 2Human?
Well, the problem was the engine. And we had written all our own engines, and we had run into a lot of problems with the engine, and it wasn't doing what we needed it to do. And we weren't getting any support that we felt was reasonable. And it delayed the game massively to the point where we rewrote the whole thing. And it was, well, then, you know, there's a litigation, and it was not fun at all.
Yeah. And that's, well, I guess now's as good a time as any to bring that up.
Yeah.
So, July 19, 2007, Silicon Knights sued Epic Games for failure to, quote, provide a working game engine, causing you guys to, quote, experience considerable losses. These are all from the suits.
Yeah.
The suit alleged that Epic was sabotaging Unreal Engine 3 licensees. Silicon Knights lost that lawsuit.
Mm.
And do you have any regrets for how all that went? And as you sit here, you know, years later?
Regrets. Well, it's a funny kind of thing. You know, I you're right. I've never talked about this ever, I don't think. Well, I regret we lost. I regret that it didn't turn out differently. But I don't know what you can do. You do the best you can with the information that you have, and we faced insurmountable problems, and so did a lot of other developers. And you know, the industry is it's a very hard place, and it's a very closed, it's a very tight-knit community.
Yeah.
And when we did that, it was extremely divisive, and we found out really quickly that people started choosing sides very fast. And that was really tough. The other thing that I underestimated was the amount of time that a lawsuit will take in your mind share is devastating. So it's not that the lawsuit didn't have its merits, or that we shouldn't have done it. But when I look back now, if I were to realize how much time I would have to put in that versus making games, I would maybe reconsider not doing it.
Yeah.
And it's not because of the loss. It's more because of the time taken away from making games. So it's tough. So anyone thinking about litigating, I would always say to them, be really careful, because it's going to take a lot of your time. And as a matter of fact, it's probably going to take almost all of your time. And then when you even when you look at X-Men Destiny, I was not working on that project a lot near the end, almost at all. And So, and I think that has a toll, and it had a toll on Silicon Knights because I was the main creative force. Even though I was the founder of the company, I had other people doing the finances and the business. Mm-hmm. I was the main creator. And then when I get sucked in wholly into a litigation where that's all you're thinking about, it's not being funneled into the creative process,
right,
which is where I think
I'm sure it's a domino effect on the rest of the team there. It strains everyone else. I'm sure
very hard on the team. It's very hard on the team.
Yeah.
I think one of the worst things when I think about the litigation is, you know, myself, like even being a wrestler and like when you wrestle, when you lose, you get beat up. It hurts. So that whole experience, I'm a big believer in life prepares you for things. And I've got some crazy stories sometimes. I don't know if we'll tell it here. We'll see. But life prepares you for things. But what I wasn't prepared for with, I would say the Epic litigation was all the damage that it caused around me. So, you know, certainly, you know, Silicon Knights was over 200 people, massive job loss, huge job loss in Niagara. Niagara is a very small town. There wasn't a lot of high tech there. It was devastating. And, the impact on the families and, all the people that were affected, was pretty devastating for me personally. That was the hardest thing. And that I wish wouldn't happen, but it happened. So like, I think for me, I've been through a lot and I'm like, okay, but that was a surprise. And that was, wish I could have done better.
So I'll ask this follow up with all due respect.
Yeah.
You got countersued, uh-huh, and they won.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens, are you able to sort of look in the mirror or sit down with a psychiatrist or whatever sort of works for you? Do you ever kind of look at that and go, okay, well, boy, if we got countersued and we lost that, mm-hmm, maybe we really were in the wrong here? Like, where do you kind of?
I don't think so. I think, you know, I obviously, you know, some people will disagree, but you have to really understand how the court systems work. And I think we were, for those people who are in the industry and what happened, we had extremely amazing evidence for what we had. And it's the court process itself. What I became really disillusioned was with the court process and how this stuff works. In many ways, the justice system, in my opinion, isn't necessarily who's right and wrong. It's really who can navigate the system better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's how we really got killed. So, the copyright stuff, you know, it was my understanding of it, from my memory now, and which is still pretty good, was there was like 1,000 lines potentially of comments, not even of code, that was later deprecated out of 3 million lines of code. So we're talking like less than 1% that they got that award for, and that's not a lot of code. So but you know, there'll be arguments, and there'll be like, and I don't want to relitigate that or bring that up, but it doesn't change my opinion on things at all.
All right, so let's fast forward. You come back a few years later with the aforementioned Shadow of the Eternals, a spiritual successor, as it was meant to be, for Eternal Darkness.
Yeah.
You go with a crowdfunding initiative on that.
Mm-hmm.
What ended up happening with that? Because as I recall it, it ended up being taken down and then put back up, I think, on another crowdfunding platform.
Yeah.
What was the story behind that?
Well, we had
gameplay footage and everything. Like, you had stuff. You had a game there.
Yeah, it was looking great. We're using the Crytek engine, and a lot of things happened. Some stuff I don't even want to talk about. It's so disturbing.
Yeah, I know I wasn't going to bring it up.
I think there was still too much collateral noise around what had just happened with the Epic litigation.
Yeah.
That there wasn't, the consumer confidence was not in line with what we were building. And what we were building, like, as far as I look back in time, we had something like, we had a running demo that people played
yeah.
at Comic-Con. Like we had like 400 people play that demo. So it was solid. It was a solid running, but it just wasn't enough to get us over the hump of confidence for the consumer. Then we had a bunch of uncontrollable things happen, and it was just didn't happen. It was very disappointing. But in some ways, like a lot of things in life, maybe in the end it's the right thing. I don't know. I love Shadow of the Eternals. And when we started Apocalypse, I looked at it and we all talked and it was like, this is not the right time for this game. There's still too much baggage with it.
Yeah.
And so we moved on. But yeah, it was really tough. Very, very hard. We worked on that. I'd say everyone in the company worked on that game for a year. Just on their own dime, and
wow.
Yeah, never came to fruition. Unfortunately, we tried.
So now we fast forward. The game behind me here on the big screen is Dead House Sonata. Mm. For those in the audience not familiar with it, give us the elevator pitch. What is this thing?
Dead House Sonata is a free-to-play game where you play the undead fighting the living. And
I like it already.
Do you?
Oh,
thanks.
Flip the script a little bit.
Yeah. I'm going back to my roots with this game and going back to the roots of what I was talking about earlier with Legacy of Kain.
Yeah.
And not from a perspective of we're going to try to remake, you know, Legacy of Kain, though I think there's certainly, the Legacy of Kain community could really need some love in that direction. And, so we're going to try to provide that, but really, when you talk about the medium, we're taking today's medium, which is wholly different from back when we were on the PlayStation 1. So today's medium is multiplayer, and a lot of people say watching games more than they're playing. So if you look at Twitch as an example,
sure,
you have more people watching a League of Legends game than are watching the Super Bowl. So you have a lot of people watching as they're working and stuff. So imagine if we integrate this medium into a game and take that medium and take advantage of it. That's what we're trying to do with Dead House Sonata. And we're trying to do story that really pretty much is ignored with multiplayer games. So we want to take a narrative approach to this. And at the same time, we want to integrate storytelling into this medium where the audience can participate. Imagine back in the day when you're sitting in a Greek play 2,000 years ago, you actually had agency where you could say that's where thumbs up, thumbs down comes from.
Yeah.
If a character would live or die, the audience could participate in that, and then the actors would take it from there. With Twitch and these new mediums that we have, where we have audience participation, imagine making a game around that medium. That's what Dead House Sonata is about.
Boy, I think you're probably the first person ever to equate Twitch to old Greek plays, and I like it. That is a cool analogy. I like that.
Oh, thanks. So that is when you look at our love for the medium, and for me, it's always the medium. What can we do? We want to change the way people think about playing games, and this is our foray into it. And in many ways, I'm a different person. I'm literally, this is a story of characters coming back from the dead, and I'm coming back from the dead. So there's always going to be a little bit of part of me in there. And I'm a changed person. I'm very similar in many ways, but in many ways, all the things that we went through with Precursor, with the Epic litigation.
Yeah.
I think now my perspective and where we're going with this story is really going to resonate. And all my experiences, all the fantastic highs that I talked about of hanging out with Kojima-san and Miyamoto-san and Iwata-san, seeing Silicon Knights get destroyed by the litigation, trying to, you know, have a few false starts like with Precursor and Shadow of the Eternals, has brought me here to do Dead House. I feel fairly confidently that Silicon Knights could not have done Dead House because it's such a different medium. We have people at Apocalypse that are like diamond League of Legends players.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people at Silicon Knights were awesome and they had like 25 to 30 years of experience, but I don't think I still keep in contact with a lot of them, my friends. They're not playing League of Legends.
Yeah.
You know, so the mediums have changed so much. Bringing in these people and doing what we're doing with this is something that inspires me. And when I go on to do something and we're trying to do something, we're trying to really make a difference in the industry. And I think that with what we're doing with Dead House Sonata is going to be very different. And there's going to be, you know, a lot of things that people know from our games they can come to expect, but it's going to be free to play, which is, hey, it's a greenfield for me. I don't claim to be an expert in it, that's for sure. But I think the free to play games give people an opportunity to try something before they invest any kind of financial investment at all. And they don't never have to
yeah.
if they don't want to. So it'll be interesting.
It's funny that you've been talking about the medium and the medium being the message and that being almost a mantra for you. Because now that I, just even over the course of this conversation, you know, you've gone from, you've really actually lived that. You've gone That's from right. probably, what, three and a half inch floppy disks to cartridges and CD-ROMs and now, yep. you know, the internet and, you know, persistent connectivity.
You know, I think it's very astute and, you know, I mentioned Dr. Barry Grant. We were talking about, you know, how each sort of he really talks about film theory and different directors and the auteur theory and what are the different techniques of Alfred Hitchcock, say, compared to other directors. Alfred Hitchcock going to be one of my favorites. And we sat down one day and we were talking and he said to me, well, what's your thing? And I sat back and I'm like, I don't know if I know. And then we started talking and then we got to the point where it's like, I think it's studying the medium. The medium for me is what I bring to the table as a director and as a creator. And not everyone thinks that way. And that's okay. It's not, there's no right or wrong thing, but, I'm hopeful, you know, cause for the longest time, and you know, you said it earlier in the interview, I've said some things that really make people angry, like cloud computing in like 2006, or I think it's going to be the future. And, you know, those kind of things are, I realize and it's because I'm thinking about the medium all the time and what can this medium do? And when I first got pulled into that whirlpool going all the way back to Richard Garriott, the medium did it for me. It was like, yeah. this medium is different than reading all the fantasy books that I used to read, watching all the movies. And to me, that's where the power of this entertainment lies. And that's what excites me. And that's what I want to make as, that's what I want to play and what I want to consume. I would love to imagine you're playing this Revenant in this, and you're trying to get through the world and understand your story and the decisions that you make help build your character. But what if the world around you, all the players who are watching you on Twitch are also making a difference on your character. Isn't that a cool experience?
That'd be cool.
Wouldn't that be something that people would want to play? I know it's something that I would want. And it's, in some sense, it's like real life. It's not only going back to the Greek plays, but it resonates with our world today. There are some things that are absolutely out of our control that define our characters, right? That we all go through life. Life is hard. And there are some things that you can't control. Well, what if we make a game experience that works in that way? And that's what we're trying to do with Dead House.
Well, you talk about, you know, getting people in there. All right, Dead House is free to play, but how do you get it out? How do you get people to even try your game in this day and age where there's, even though the digital marketplaces are bursting at the seams, even, you know, they're sort of curated, but like, yeah, how do you even break through the noise now?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't
know.
Have that Nintendo seal of approval that only
right.
you know, a handful of games get on the shelf anymore.
Right. There's certainly, you know, some people would say marketing spend, but I think the old traditional ways of marketing your products are becoming less and less effective every day. And I think we're trying some things. What's really... So you were asking me, you know, before, you know, how do you know if a game's going to be good all the way back from Legacy of Kain? And when we were doing Legacy of Kain, some of the things we were doing, people were like, well, I've never seen that before. Or with the Two Human demo that got us with Nintendo and the Seamless Cinemas. Though people had just started seeing it, it was pretty novel. And I think that's what's starting to happen in the game space when it comes to getting out there in the marketplace. I don't know. is the answer. I don't know if anyone knows. I know we're starting to hear things like performance marketing, which was a fairly new term to me. And what that means is you see what works and what doesn't, and you follow the leads, and but it's all based upon metrics and clicks. And
right.
That's all data, right? So I think that's one of the ways. I think with what we're doing, we're huge believers in community interaction. And even back when, I don't know if you remember this, but man, I used to post on the IGN forums for Eternal Darkness, and gamers would really respond. And I try to answer. Back in those days, it was really hard when you're in crunch mode to get feedback from the forums and actually implement that into your game is super hard.
Yeah.
However, with these games, if we release an early alpha, a closed alpha, and people say, we really like this, this sucks, change this, this is horrible. What you can iterate your game and work with gamers to create the game that they want to create. And I think that is so powerful. I think that's going to dominate the industry. And I think it's starting to show now. I think you're starting to see free-to-play games. Now, clearly with some of the big games where they're dominating, but I think you're going to not only see dominance in the sales, but you're going to see dominance in the quality of product because of the way the model is.
Right.
The fact that we have an opportunity to interact with gamers. And again, I think we work for gamers. I think that is something that you cannot move away from. And I think you guys espouse to the same thing. You work for your consumers. You want to get them the news. You mm-hmm. want to show them the products that they want to see. And you work for consumers too. And I think you always must stay consumer focused because, without gamers and game fans saying that they like Legacy of Kain or they like Eternal Darkness, what good is it? What does it service? It services nothing. So my job is to entertain and hopefully bring people to a place where they have memorable experiences and can escape life. And that's why I think these new models are so exciting. But I don't pretend to know the answer beyond what I've said. So
what do you hope that your legacy is in this industry one day after you've retired and however many years from now?
Yeah, I hope people remember my games for trying new things and making a difference in the industry. I know I was talking to a lot of people about this, especially when you're going through good times, you get lots of friends. And when you're going through bad times, that's when you're going through the tough times is you realize where your true friends are, because they'll still talk to you and not look at you like you have leprosy and stuff. And those when I started asking those questions like, was this a good game? Why did this happen? Why did this game resonate? And why did people like this game and not this game as much? And what did I do right? What did I do wrong? And in the end, another friend, another academic of mine, said to me, Dr. Jeff Howard, he's like, when we were talking about Too Human at the time and all the research that we did into Norse mythology and how that resonated with people, still have a lot of gamers coming up to me saying, Dennis, I love the story in Too Human, would love to see a sequel. And surprisingly, a lot of people don't know this, Too Human sold 1 million copies, did much better than what the perception is, and which is crazy, right? People are like, oh, that game didn't do that well. No, that game actually did pretty well.
Was Microsoft mad about all that?
I don't know. I have to ask them. I don't want to speak for Microsoft. but it was one of their best-selling games that year. And but he said to me that it's the story that will be remembered. It's the work that will be remembered. And that helped me a lot. And I think, when you look at your body of work, you hope that it's remembered for the good things and for the things that you contributed. And I hope that people see that we tried to do something different. And a lot of the stuff comes from the heart, like even the Sanity system. I'm sure a lot of gamers have heard the story before, but I was really frustrated to hear about the movement about violence in video games causing people to become violent. There was no evidence for it. So, and I was on the committees looking at some of the research for the IGDA and all that kind of stuff. And I just got so frustrated. I was like, well, people think we're messing with their heads. Let's try. Let's see what happens. And that's where that spawned from, out of my emotional frustration with what was happening in the real world. So, and in many ways, Dead House Sonata, I feel like I'm coming back from the dead. So you're going to get that piece of me. And hopefully it'll resonate well with people. That's what I hope gets remembered.
All right. Well, Dead House Sonata, the new game, the free-to-play Action RPG, fair to call?
Yeah, action RPG, multiplayer. Yes. And we've got one thing I want to talk about, if it's okay.
Please.
I've got a cat shirt on.
Yes.
And we, with, as we're at store, will be open by now. We have an adopt-a-cat drive. So if you adopt a cat and show that you've adopted a cat, we'll give you twice the amount of in-game currency. So we
That's
have,
great.
Yeah, we have three adopted cats in the studio. This guy kind of looks like Lord Cheeseburger. And we adopted three cats. We went into the Humane Society. We said, because we knew we could take probably three cats. It's a big office. And I said, give us two cats, or give us some cats that no one will adopt. So we got a couple cats that couldn't be separated. They were brother and sister. Yeah. They were 7 years old and pretty overweight. So that means there'll be some medical problems with them. And I thought, okay, so we adopted them. And that's Lord Cheeseburger and Callie. And then we got another little kitten. I was like, okay, this little kitten will keep them active. And maybe we'll start to, you know, reinvigorate them. And people looking at me say, Dennis, you're probably not the best person for advice on weight loss. And I would agree. And so we got this little kitten, Rev. And it went the wrong way. So now he's getting a little tubby. And, but if you adopt a cat, we love you for it. And, we will reward you with our, in our in-game store and our currency and stuff. So check it out.
I love that. That's great stuff.
Thank you.
What website? Give a quick plug for the website.
Yeah. Buy-deadhouse.com. Buy-deadhouse.com.
Perfect. Deadhouse Sonata will be keeping a close eye on it here at IGN. Dennis Dyack, thank you so much. This was a real treat to take a walk through your, again, as you said, just, what a roller coaster of a career. Just yeah. a lot of great stories. And yeah, really looking forward to seeing how you've been spending your time the last couple of years with Deadhouse Sonata here. So for more from the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry, I've got new episodes of IGN Unfiltered every month. There's 40-something of them on IGN, YouTube, or your favorite podcast service. So if you've enjoyed this, we've got interviews with plenty of other folks. Check those out. Dennis, thanks again.
My pleasure.
And we'll see you next month.
Thank you.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.